You're listening to Upfront. I'm Brian Edwards-Tiekert. Whichever Democrat staggers to victory in what is shaping up to be history's longest presidential primary, they are headed to a general election contest against a man who is practically a virtuoso at stoking fear, resentment, and racism to put together an electoral coalition. Now, the problem with campaigning against someone like Donald Trump making thinly veiled racial appeals is that just calling it out as racism doesn't actually seem to be terribly effective at combating it. Our next guest has devoted an immense amount of time to trying to understand this conundrum, the problem, what kind of politics it might take to overcome it. Ian Haney Lopez teaches race and constitutional law at UC Berkeley. He co-founded the Race Class Narrative Project, and he's now written about that work in his book Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections, and Saving America. Ian Haney Lopez, thank you so much for coming in.
Well, thank you. I'm very glad to be here.
I want to ground the conversation in some basic concepts you work from. The first you devoted your last book to, dog whistle politics. What is a dog whistle?
So think about a term like illegal alien or welfare queen, Sharia law, or contrary-wise, think about the real Americans, silent majority, American heartland, make America great again. On their surface, none of these phrases are explicitly about race, but they have a very strong, and in fact, they have a purposefully designed tendency to trigger racist thinking. That's dog whistling. Dog whistling is the use of language that is intentionally designed to trigger racist fears and to allow plausible deniability. And now, I want to say just a little bit more about that. This definition of dog whistling differs from the way in which dog whistling is commonly understood. Dog whistling is commonly understood as speaking in code, using language that's ambiguous and that is understood one way by a certain audience and in a more particular way by a more focused audience. I think it's a mistake to understand dog whistling that way. That's simply too generic. In fact, that tends to describe retail politics in general. It's simply the case that politicians always are talking to multiple audiences in a heterogeneous society like ours, and that they're intentionally and sometimes unintentionally using language that has multiple meanings. There's nothing especially pernicious about that. It's a mistake to call that dog whistle politics. And to be more pointed, sometimes people have said of, for example, President Barack Obama, that when he used phrases like "we shall overcome" that were especially resonant with the African-American community, that he was dog whistling to African-Americans. That somehow suggests that there's an equation, an equivalence between Obama on the one hand and Trump on the other. I think that's an enormous mistake. I think it's far better to understand dog whistling as an intentional effort to use a coded language that triggers, that invokes unpopular, unacceptable social hierarchy, social hatreds, and that then pretends it's not doing so. That's what's democratically destructive about dog whistling. You have a politician and indeed a political party that is intentionally stoking racial hatreds through the language it uses, and then turning around and, because it's in code, saying, "What, me? No, we're not doing that at all."
So it's exploiting this kind of strange feature of American politics, which is that since the civil rights movement, basically, it's been socially unacceptable to be racist. Most of us do not think of ourselves as racist. But the social programming that comes with 500 years of living in a racially stratified society means that just about all of us at an unconscious level hold some level of racist anxiety and association.
That's exactly right. And it's a really good point. It pushes to yet another distinction we can make in dog whistling. Dog whistling really gets started in the wake of the civil rights movement. It really gets started in the 1960s at the moment when it's becoming culturally unacceptable, certainly nationally, but even in the South, to be explicit about white supremacy. So the first dog whistles are terms like states' rights or freedom of association. And it's simply evident to everybody at the time that states' rights means the rights of Southern states to resist federal demands that they stop humiliating and oppressing African Americans. This is an understanding of dog whistling in which the politician is communicating a message that is clearly heard by a target audience. And dog whistling certainly works that way. We can think about Trump and very fine people as a message directed towards white nationalists, who were indeed quite pleased that he said that. But that's not the main way dog whistling works now. Dog whistling now works principally because it aims to trigger racist fears and stereotypes in the vast majority of us. And this is something completely different. That is, the vast majority of us, and we have data, I'll talk about it in just a second, but the vast majority of us respond positively to dog whistle messages because we've deeply internalized these racist fears and stereotypes, but we don't recognize them as such.
So the point is, Donald Trump isn't so much giving a secret handshake saying, hey, you know you're racist, I know you're racist, we can't say we're racist together, but we know we're on the same team. He's actually trying to induce more racism in the people his messages are reaching.
Such an important point. Such an important point. It's a huge mistake to think that dog whistling is about Donald Trump talking to a bunch of self-aware racists who know they're racist and just don't think it's politic to admit it. That's not the main dynamic. That might be happening with 5-7% of reactionary voters.
The people with white supremacist tattoos who showed up to phone bank for him.
Exactly. And the alt-right. And I think someone like Steve Bannon, I would say, right? These are people who know what they're doing. They know that they're committed to white nationalism, to the supremacy of the white race. They know that they feel that they believe consciously there's a racial threat to the country from black and brown immigrants. They're self-conscious in the sense that whites are superior and that non-whites are inferior and a threat. But again, that's a very, very small subset of Trump's base. The vast majority of Trump voters are people who are genuinely convinced they are against racism. And yet, they are triggered by comments about Sharia law or undocumented immigrants or terrorists coming to kill us or welfare queens. And I would say even further, and this is really important, we're not just talking about people who vote for Trump. In our research on how to combat dog whistling, we wanted to measure the efficacy of dog whistling. So we tested in a nationally representative poll, 2,000 people, nationally representative. We tested a dog whistle message, and the message talked about the need to prioritize our own people, to keep people out of the country who come from terrorists, out of the United States who come from terrorist countries who mean us harm, all of that sort of classic dog whistle language. We found that it was quite popular with conservatives, but even more striking, people rated it as convincing. Who were a majority of people in union households, a majority of the Democratic base, a majority of African Americans, and a majority of Latinos. So even when we think, well, people of color aren't going to fall for this, that's not true. The right is using coded language that frames an implicit conflict between hardworking Americans and welfare cheats, between law-abiding folks and criminals and gangbangers. When they use that language, it simply sounds like common sense, even to a majority of blacks and African Americans, a majority of Democrats, a majority of union households. That's the power of this message. We might step back in critics and say, well, clearly underlying those frames is a story of innocent whites being victimized by dangerous and undeserving people of color. I think that's right analytically. It's simply not the way the majority of Americans are responding. That's the challenge. The right is using a story of racial conflict that the vast majority of Americans find convincing.
And find convincing at this kind of subliminal level. One of the points you make early in the book, which is interesting to me, is that because this is appeal to people's unconscious biases, the act of calling it out as racism triggers cognitive dissonance in those people. They go, oh no, I'm not racist. At an abstract level, I am committed to a racially equal society. However, these messages appeal to my implicit association between dark skin and criminality and so on and so forth. So suddenly, you are the jerk who is calling voters racist.
Yes, yes. And more than just the jerk, you're actually confirming what the Republicans are telling the public. So the Republicans, and I say the Republicans, I want to be clear about this as a partisan matter. the Republican Party was a racially moderate party through the 40s, 50s, 60s. It really begins to shift in the 1960s. They recognize, starting in 1963, that they can use race as a wedge issue against the Democrats. Once they get that going, they unleash a demon that they can't control, because in effect, they've committed to a politics of demagoguery, a politics of scaring voters about dangerous and undeserving people of color. And there's no limit to, you know, the next generation of politician who's going to come along and be even more extreme. Over the last 50 years, moderates have been almost entirely driven out of the Republican Party, replaced by these really incendiary demagogues. And Donald Trump really sort of epitomizes that process, the way in which he was able to capture the Republican nomination in 2016. It surprised the establishment in the party. But okay, so I'll say Republican, but really I mean something more like racial reactionaries, right? Mm-hmm. They have now a process in which their core message is the United States is a white country. Whites built this country. Whites are decent, hardworking, and deserving, and they're under threat. They're under threat from violent and lazy blacks and waves of new immigrants coming from black and yellow parts of the world. That's the core message, but it's expressed in these coded terms, again, that the majority of people find reasonable and common sense. Now, enter the Democrats or any of the rest of us progressives who turn around and say, hey, that's racist. What happens? Well, one, most people don't hear it as racist. They hear it as common sense. So when they hear the claim that these sorts of things about illegal immigrants are really racist, they engage in a pretty aggressive process of self-defense, say, that's not racist, and I'm not racist, and I'm pretty pissed off at you for calling me a racist. And then there's the next move where they begin to say, actually, you're the one being racist because you're stereotyping me just because I'm worried about illegal immigrants, just because I'm worried about crime or welfare. You're stereotyping me as a racist. That is, you're judging me on the basis of my race and my views. That's racist of you. And the third move, and this is the sort of deepest move, they say to themselves, wow, you're really confirming what the right is telling me. We are a country locked into a racial conflict, and I've got to pick racial sides. And one side makes sense. They're saying, let's protect ourselves from criminals and let's demand that everybody work instead of just live off of a welfare. And the other side is busy calling me a racist and being racist against me. What side should I choose?
I wonder, reading this part of the book, it made me wonder if some of the vocabulary that has come out of social justice circles engaging in much needed anti-racist reflection and training hasn't been counterproductive when it moves to a popular audience. So when I first learned about racism in school, it's Bull Connor, right? It's segregation today, segregation tomorrow. It's people who wear the racism on their sleeve. And I think for a lot of white Americans, that's what racism means. And sure, you can go into the 8-hour challenging white supremacy training session in your social justice group and come up with a much more profound understanding of how we operate with implicit and unconscious biases and absorb them from our society and come out with a much more expanded definition of what racism means. That is going to leave someone who's not been to the same training very cold when you start using racism in your newly expanded definition.
Yeah, I think that's right. And just to be clear, as a matter of my own sort of intellectual biography, I come out of a racial justice framework. Starting in law school a fair number of years ago now, I was really concerned with racism against communities of color. And I was operating very strongly within a framework that saw racism as inherent in the United States, as widely shared among whites, as a system of oppression that privileged whites but that harmed communities of color. That is, I was operating within a framework that saw racism primarily as a conflict, as a hierarchy of whites over non-whites. Mm-hmm. This is the same frame in which I think almost all racial justice activists are operating. Frankly, it's also the frame that's promoted by the right, that there's a fundamental conflict between whites and non-whites. So there's that first risk. We're starting to use a frame that the right itself is promoting. Now, they have a different conclusion. In this conflict, whites need to band together, whereas the progressive conclusion is, in this conflict, whites need to renounce their privilege. Mm-hmm. But it's the same story. Racism is basically a conflict between whites and people of color. If you think that, you probably think the way I thought for many years. Since racism is primarily white over non-white hierarchy, relatively few whites are going to give up their privilege. Relatively few whites are going to be willing to admit the structural advantages they receive, the way in which their privilege, the cultural norms, the implicit biases they've internalized. We can count on a small handful of radical whites to join us. But racism itself is never going to end. And it's not going to end because it remains in the interest of a white population that's benefited from it and that refuses to acknowledge those benefits or to dismantle them. Now, what do we do as anti-racist activists? We try and build what power we can for communities of color on the margins of society. We speak truth to power, but we sort of make peace with the bitter recognition that this is never going to end. Right? And I have to say, this is the perspective I was coming from. I came out of this school. I recognize it now. I think it's quite prevalent. And I think that you look at the success of Donald Trump and you look at the resurgence of white supremacy. And of course, many people are saying to themselves, this country's irredeemably racist. Yes, maybe we elected a black president, but it didn't fundamentally change the racist nature of this country or of the white population. We need to build what power we can among communities of color, but we're not going to get past racism.
So the turn you make in the book is that actually racism in this country does not principally work to benefit white people. It principally works to benefit wealthy elites who are able to distract white people from things that are actually in most of their financial interest.
That's the epiphany, or at least a personal epiphany. I want to be clear. The insight is, wait a minute, racism, conflict between whites and people of color, hierarchy of whites over people of color, yes. But that's not the principal dynamic. What is the principal dynamic? That racial hierarchy is being funded and promoted in the interests of economic elites. That is, that racism is a class weapon. And I want to be very clear, this isn't saying that class explains everything about race. Racism is its own dynamic now that has been going on for 400 years. It sometimes works against class interests. I also want to be clear, I'm not saying that class is primary and that race is secondary. When I say racism is a class weapon, I mean to give both equal emphasis. Because racism is the principal class weapon in the United States, it must be given equal attention along with class hierarchy. But here's the insight. This is the same insight that from Bacon's rebellion against slavery, from the fusion movement after the Civil War, Martin Luther King and the Poor People's Campaign. The insight is racism primarily benefits the economic elite, the power elite in society, and it does so through a divide and conquer politics that pits the rest of us against each other. The more we fight each other, the more the elites win and we struggle. And this was a sort of an insight that, again, prevalent across American history that I had lost sight of. I think that many people in the racial justice community had lost sight of. But it really became salient again with Obama's election, at least for me. Mm-hmm. 2008, the country elects a black president. That's important. I don't think we should minimize just what that signifies in terms of racial progress for the country. And yet we shouldn't overstate what that means, because at the moment that the country elects a black president, we're also engaged in this massive war on crime, incredible over-policing and state violence against communities of color, racialized mass incarceration. Obama himself will turn and develop mass deportations that are disproportionately targeting people of Latino origins. And at the same time, you get this Tea Party, this backlash that's fueled by race. Racism is very powerfully still operating. What explains this juxtaposition between the election of a black president and these powerful structural and cultural expressions of racism? And what explains it is the role of racism as politics. That's when it really became apparent that racism plays such an important role in our country, because one political party organized its appeals around racial fear, the Republicans, and that the Democrats ended up responding in very similar terms. That's what produced a competition between Republicans and Democrats to show who could crack down on black and brown communities the most through the criminal law. That's what drove Obama to try and prove his bona fides protecting the American public from supposedly threatening brown immigrants. It's that sort of politics that explains the Tea Party. And behind that politics, big money. If you look at the Tea Party, it's the Koch brothers. If you look at the Republican Party, it's the party of big business. If you look at the Democrats move away from people of color and towards Wall Street and begin to participate in a dog whistle politics that oppresses, that demonizes people of color, at the same time that they begin to draw increasing resources and increasing support from Wall Street and from corporations. And so this is the moment when we can see really clearly racism is operating as the way in which economic power elites are winning political power. And nobody, just to put a pin in it, nobody better exemplifies this than Donald Trump. Here's this corrupt billionaire who wins office by chanting, build a wall, and I'm going to ban all Muslims. And his major accomplishment is to pass a tax cut for the billionaire class. And he came ever so close to getting rid of the Affordable Care Act, which would have stripped health care for tens of thousands, for millions of people, but would have allowed even further tax cuts for the very rich.
So I want to dig into this argument a little bit, because on the surface of it, it's a little counterintuitive to say racism is just about business elites and business interests. Most business elites in this country would love a much more liberal immigration policy. They would like the workforce. The Koch brothers do not want to be paying for the mass incarceration of African Americans. The sprawling prison complex in this country, by and large, is not good for business elites, although there's specific people who make money off of it. To the extent there's discrimination in things like hiring and promotion, that tends to make firms run less efficiently. So you're saying we have a political system in which all of those inefficiencies are acceptable collateral damage as long as the politics that produces them also get someone like Donald Trump into office to cut their taxes and their regulations.
That's exactly right. So we have a democracy. We have an electoral competition between two parties. One of those parties, the party of big business, the Republican Party, has historically tied its success to serving the interests of economic elites. But how do you serve the interests of economic elites when those interests come at the expense of the vast majority of voters? When we tested some of the sort of neoliberal nostrums that the right says that a lot of people believe in, tax cuts for the rich, corporations writing their own regulation, a government getting out of the way of business, all of those sort of things, those propositions failed miserably in a head-to-head against economic positions that said redistribute wealth downward, affordable health care for all, support for unions. In a head-to-head, the economic policies that serve the rich lose big time to economic policies that actually build a middle class and make sure that routes of upward mobility are created for working families. So the Republican Party decided in the wake of the civil rights movement, they would run on cultural issues, and in particular on the cultural issue of racial resentment, though they very quickly also picked up the cultural issues of patriarchy and homophobia. And they were going to move votes on that level. A lot of corporations, a lot of corporate elites may themselves be socially liberal. And they certainly, from a point of view of publicity and sort of the public standing, the public face of their corporations, would espouse views that are socially liberal. But more than that social liberalism, what they want is a political regime that has very low taxes for corporations and the rich, that allows corporations control over the regulatory apparatus of the state, and in which the government does very little not only to redistribute wealth downward, but does very little to invest in infrastructure or invest in routes of upward mobility that are costly and that require high taxes. Those are the policies that are good for the very rich. There are some tensions about the way in which the Republican Party has been successful in winning votes to enact those policies. But the bottom line is the Republican Party has been. Think about Donald Trump. If you he may be saying ugly things, and there may be a lot of corporate leaders who don't like him, wouldn't want to be seen with him, want to make sure that they're not publicly identified with him. And yet they're really quite supportive of a politics and a political party that is very quickly passing massive tax cuts for the rich and also handing over control over the regulatory apparatus of states, the Environmental Protection Agency and the environment and the energy department to corporations. If there has to be some trade-off, that's a trade-off they're willing to make.
All right. So we've got a working definition of dog whistle politics. It is not the secret handshake between two racists. It is actually someone with a platform trying to induce racial anxiety in their target audience, the electorate. We have a purpose for dog whistle politics. It is to make a lot of white people vote against their own collective economic self-interest. And we have a tactical challenge with it, which is that calling it out as racist doesn't necessarily change anyone's mind, because most people in America think of ourselves as non-racist, even if we harbor at a subconscious level racial biases that dog whistle politics speak to. So now the question, the bulk of your book, what do you do about it?
Yeah, perfect. So one more element to just to throw in there, just to thoroughly demoralize people. Democrats were very quick to figure out that whole structure, that whole analysis. Hey, party big business, going to use race against us, going to break up a coalition of African Americans, the white working class, and liberal elites. If we call them racist, we're going to lose. They figured that out as early as 1970. So what did they say? They said, well, if we can't call them racist, we can't talk about race at all. So let's not talk about race.
Which is a white person, very, very comfortable to not talk about
it's
race.
Right, super comfortable, right? I mean, I think that was very much part of it. It's like, well, let's move to this sort of position of colorblindness. Let's focus on what supposedly unites us. Let's talk about healthcare or infrastructure or wages. We'll do an economic platform because that would help everybody. That unites us. We can't talk about race. That divides us.
Right? So classically, like Lyndon Johnson makes Appalachia the poster child for his war on poverty.
I think that's part of it. But I would say, really, for me, the poster child of all of this is what the Democratic Party does immediately after Donald Trump wins. Mm. And they announce that they're going to do this thing that they call a better deal. Right. And it is a clear gesture towards the New Deal, to the economic programs of the New Deal. Not very aggressive at all as economic policies, but even more significantly, Donald Trump has just won on the basis of all of this racial fear and animosity. And the Democrats respond by saying, hey, we're going to propose a better deal in which we're going to have 15 different economic policies and we're not going to talk about race at all. Mm-hmm. That is a class only approach. That is a racial strategy. The fact that it's superficially only about economics is a racial strategy. The racial strategy of not talking about race because you think mentioning race is going to cost you white voters, Right. And so right now, we're...
Seems like you're leaving one element of the historic Democratic playbook off the table, which is actually adopting the dog whistle
yes.
language. I mean, this was the Clinton years, right?
Absolutely. So another way you can think about the strategy of not talking about it is you can think about Michael Dukakis and the Willie Horton ads. The Willie Horton ad comes out. It's an ad that depicts an African-American has a mugshot of him saying, hey, he's somebody. He's kidnapped a couple, stabbed the man, raped the woman, right? It's a very strong, very visceral ad. And Dukakis stays within this frame of, I'm not going to talk about it. I'm not going to call it out. I'm going to ignore it. And in the intervening month in which he's ignoring it, he goes from leading over George Bush to trailing and ultimately loses the election. And Democrats say to themselves, so this is the structure. Race is going to be used against us. We can't call it out. We can't ignore it. And now we get to Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton says, well, if you can't beat him, join him. And Bill Clinton starts his own version of dog whistling, talking about ending welfare as a way of life, cracking down on crime. These are the dog whistle themes that the Republicans have been using. Now, I'm supposing that in 2020, we're not going to see Democrats doing the sort of full Bill Clinton-esque imitation of dog whistling. So they're defaulting back to these other two alternatives. You get a segment of the Democrats, the sort of center of the Democratic Party, the DCCC, kind of saying, let's just push for economics as the centerpiece of what we're doing. We're going to focus on economics. We're going to avoid talking about difficult issues like race. Amy Klobuchar, for example, Joe Biden, for example. Then you get another element of the Democratic Party, the more progressive wing, saying, we see clearly that racism is being used to divide us. People of color are just an incredibly energetic and important segment of the Democratic base. We need to call out this racism. We need to call Donald Trump what he is. Call him a racist. Empower communities of color. That's how we're going to win. So now we're back. What are we going to do? Are we going to call out the racism and lose white voters? Or are we going to ignore the racism and focus on class only and risk marginalizing and leaving communities of color on the sideline? Those are the choices that most Democrats think they face.
Yeah, I thought this was really clear. The Sanders campaign has come a long way since then. But in the 2016 primary cycle, you'll remember there was a moment where Black Lives Matter activists were targeting Sanders events to try to get their issues spoken to. And what was very clear after a couple of those encounters was he didn't have a language for speaking to those issues extemporaneously. Now, in the wake of those call-outs, his campaign came out with a very elaborate criminal justice reform platform that I think spoke to a lot of those concerns. But this was not in his political vocabulary as the leftmost Democrat in the Senate to say something like, yeah, the cops should stop killing Black kids.
Right. Okay. So two options. Call out the racism and focus on empowering communities of color, or ignore it and go big on economic populism. One solution is do both. Mm-hmm. But there's a tension, right? There's a tension. The economic populism, qua economic populism, is framed in a way that ends up leaving behind a lot of the concerns of communities of color, and it's designed to reassure whites that Democrats care about them and that they're going to be the main focus. And then the focus on racial justice is a focus that's designed to reassure communities of color, but does alienate many whites who feel like, wow, all this talk about mass incarceration and reparations, this just confirms the Republican story that Democrats and Democratic elites care more about people of color than they do about me. So doing both, it doesn't avoid the tension. It simply says we got to do both, and hopefully we won't lose too many whites and too many people of color. Right. So it's not a solution. Here's the solution. Here's the pivot. And this goes back to this paradigm change in how we think about racism. Shift to talking about racism as a weapon of elites against all of us in a way that causally links racial justice and economic populism. And to make this more concrete, imagine that when Black Lives Matter activists interrupted Bernie in 2016, he had said, I'm so glad you're here, because what you're pointing to is the power of racial division in our society. And we need to fight that racial division, partly because of all the terrible things it does to communities of color, but all the more because it's racial division that has allowed the restructuring of our economic system. Economic elites benefit from racial fear and division. And if we want economic populism, and here he could have been Bernie, he's like, I want a revolution. I want health care. I want strong unions. I want living wage. I want all of these things, and I can't get any of them until I address racial division and create a sense of social solidarity across race lines. Only when we create a sense of solidarity across race lines, when we name racial division as a weapon against all of us, do we have any possibility of building the supermajorities we need to make the sorts of bold economic plans that Bernie has a realistic legislative possibility.
So what you're saying is, don't shy away from calling out the racism, but don't stop at calling it out. Explain what the racism is doing, whose interest it's serving, and implicitly say the people pushing this racism are not doing it sincerely.
That's right. It's a con. Call it out as a con. So if you call out the racism in a way that presents racism basically as a white problem, that will backfire. You're going to lose a lot of white voters. And in our research, we found that actually a lot of people in communities of color, not the activists, but a lot of regular folks in communities of color don't like a message in which they have to confront pervasive white racism. That message is a very poor way to organize people. That is not the same thing as saying stop talk about racism. That's a mistake too. The point is talk about racism differently. Talk about racism as something that has been weaponized against all of us. What does this do? It gets people to focus on the real threat in their lives, the economic titans that are increasingly running this society for their own benefit. At the same time, it allows whites to say to themselves, I'm not being blamed. I'm not the main problem here. In fact, I'm being hurt by this too, and I'm an important ally in this multiracial movement. And this is very important too, it allows people of color to say to themselves, a multiracial coalition is realistically possible because it's going to be founded on the self-interest of whites in working with us to remake this society so that all of us can thrive. This is not the sort of multiracial coalition based on morality or kumbaya or hand-holding and, you know, singing songs in which we have no confidence this is actually going to work. Now, I don't want to belittle the hand-holding, the singing songs. I don't mean to belittle that. The language of morality, the language, the sort of affection, the solidarity, the community, that's incredibly important. But that's the way that self-interest is often expressed. We have to pay attention to the self-interest of everybody in joining a multiracial coalition rather than saying we can convince people to join a multiracial coalition when it's against their interest. That's the second part. That's the part that I'm warning against. But build that sense of self-interest and then build it in a way that's infused with morality and joy and song and marches. Absolutely. But recognize that the way you get people into movement is by convincing them that that's the best way for them to take care of themselves and their children.
You're making an argument about how to run a persuasion campaign. And I'm imagining someone responding to this by saying, I am sick of building a politics around accommodating the prejudices of white people in this society. Donald Trump won in a very low turnout election in which he lost the popular vote by a margin of 3 million. Can we please just worry about turning more people out next time and not catering to the prejudices of white voters?
There's so much there to unpack. So the short answer is not if you actually want to change the direction of society. Yes, it might be possible to win a national election simply by, you know, politics as usual. We might even be able to get Bernie elected with a sort of a strong economic populist message. He won't be able to enact anything. And I think actually one of the great attractions of Sanders and also of Warren is that they understand it's not enough to articulate these policies. They're going to have to spend their presidency campaigning to build popular support for them. Why? Because we're going to need supermajorities to transform who's in Congress, to transform state government across the country. How do you build those supermajorities? There, the answer is, can we build those supermajorities without dealing with racial division in this country, the fears and anxieties of many white folks and many folks of color, too, Latino, Asian American, Pacific Islander, and also African American? Can we do that? The answer there is an emphatic no. That's on one level. Here's another level. Stop thinking about a racist as like a one thing, like people, stop thinking about people as one dimensional, as either racist or not racist. People are a combination. Again, remember, the majority of Democrats, union households, African Americans, and Latinos find messages of racial fear convincing when they're expressed in code. Are these people racist? Yeah, in a sense they are, in the sense that they're drawing on deeply internalized stereotypes that negatively portray people of color and positively portray whites. Are they anti-racist? You bet. They're also anti-racist. They're committed to the idea of racial egalitarianism and equality between people of different skin colors. They're both, and they're toggling back and forth. That same thing is true. That idea of people being both and toggling back and forth in a complicated mixture, that's true of whites as well. Right? And we need to see that we cannot simply condemn everybody who votes for Trump as lost to society. Right? That's nearly half the country. Last point, most fundamental point. Is this approach of thinking about race as a class weapon designed to create room for whites to join a multiracial coalition? Hell yes. There will be no successful multiracial coalition. There will be no radical transformation in America, in our trajectory, without majority support from whites. But that's not the problem. The problem is Democrats have traditionally tried to win support from whites by sacrificing the interests of communities of color. That's the problem. The issue is, are we trying to win white support by sacrificing people of color, by throwing them under the bus, by either refusing to talk about racial justice or worse, by adopting a politics of mass incarceration or mass deportation, as Democrats have done? Absolutely not. This is an approach that says what's good for Americans in terms of economic populism is good for communities of color in terms of ending racial oppression. Think about mass incarceration and mass deportation. Those are the greatest sources of violence against communities of color today and has been over the last 20, 30, 40 years, or systemic neglect and disinvestment from communities of color. What is that rooted in? It is not rooted first and foremost in a sort of latent prejudice among whites. It is rooted first and foremost in a plutocratic politics in which politicians campaign based on racial fear, so that they can serve the interests of dark money donors. If you're committed to abolishing ICE, to ending mass incarceration, to reparations, to building investments in communities of color, your best route forward is by making common cause with folks who are committed to economic justice and who are committed to challenging and overturning the new plutocracy. The best route toward racial justice is a multiracial coalition that is aimed at a sort of a new economy. The best route for economic populists, for economic radicals, is a multiracial coalition that genuinely gets past racial division. We can build this coalition and through this multiracial populist coalition achieve what progressives want, both in terms of class and in terms of racial justice. But if we try and go it alone, some people focused on race, some people focused on economic populism, both sides will lose.
Ian Haney Lopez, that is a strong note to end on. I want to thank you so much for coming in to talk about the book.
Thank you so much. It's been terrific.
Ian Haney Lopez is a professor of law at UC Berkeley. He teaches race and constitutional law there. He co-founded the Race Class Narrative Project and writes about his work with that project in his brand new book. It is entitled Merge Left, Fusing Race and Class, Winning Elections and Saving America. And if you haven't gotten enough of the conversation, you can come see Ian Haney Lopez on the KPFA stage. He will be giving a talk this Wednesday, January 22nd, 7:30 p.m. at the Kahila Synagogue at 1300 Grand Avenue in Oakland. That's going to be emceed by Saru Jayaraman.